This episode is brought to you by Klaviyo. Did you know that top brands drive 50% of their e-commerce revenue with Klaviyo? Consolidate your channels, including email, SMS, mobile push, and reviews, and centralize and use data from across your tech stack to grow your business and revenue faster and more efficiently than ever. Power smarter digital relationships with the platform built for e-commerce. To learn more, head to klaviyo.com/glossy. That's klaviyo.com/glossy. Hello, and welcome back to the Glossy Week in Review podcast. I'm your host, senior fashion reporter Danny Parisi, and I have a special guest host today. I'm here with Sarah Ball. Sarah is the editor-in-chief of Wall Street Journal magazine. Sarah, you've also worked at a bunch of other fashion media places over the years. You were at Condé Nast for a while, GQ and Vanity Fair. Have you been covering like style and fashion that entire time?
I have. So I actually started as a Hollywood and entertainment reporter at Newsweek magazine. And before I went to Condé for almost 10 years, both at VF and GQ, as you mentioned, and then also a brief stint at Tatler in the UK, which
That's right.
Is a magazine that doesn't exist here in the US because we do not have a royal family and aristocracy in the same way, but it is a kind of fun and over-the-top society magazine in the UK. So I dabbled around Condé for about 10 years before coming to the Journal.
Nice.
And have been at WSJ Magazine since 2018.
Well, it's great to have you. And the topics we're going to talk about, I feel like, are all kind of perfectly in line with, you know, your whole experience, including your time with like the royal family coverage, because we will talk a little bit about the Kate Middleton situation later.
It's all my group chats are blowing up still about it somehow 4 days later.
And you guys also just had your spring men's fashion issue just came out with, I think it was Kevin Hart on the cover.
That's right. Kevin Hart is the recipient in a few days' time of the Mark Twain Prize, which is the Pulitzer or Nobel Peace Prize of comedy. It puts him kind of in the pantheon of all-time American greats like Richard Pryor and George Carlin, Tina Fey. But it's an interesting sort of step for him because, as you may or may not know about Kevin Hart, he's a really commercial comedian. He's built this enormous touring empire. He has a media company. And that, you know, in some cases, some comedians have said that's maybe at odds with someone who's really dedicated to the craft of joke making and touring small time on the club. So it's basically the commerce versus art debate as borne out through Kevin. But it's a really, it's a great story and shot by a wonderful photographer, Balad Banjo, in London on Polaroid. So it's kind of a cool artsy feel to a really commercial sort of guy.
Yeah, well, it's great that you're on because we're going to be talking about fashion media, magazine stuff. Our first topic, I want to talk about LVMH potentially buying Paris Match, which is a storied French magazine, very photo-heavy news and celebrity features kind of stuff. We'll also talk a little bit about the potential TikTok ban, and then we'll talk a little bit about the Oscars and some other celebrity stuff. So all within your wheelhouse, and I'm glad that you're here to talk about it. But let's start with this LVMH news about Paris Match. So this actually, I think the report came out a couple of weeks ago. Lagardère, I think I say that right, is the company that owns Paris Match, French magazine that's, I think, almost 100 years old. They said that LVMH had put in a pretty substantial bid to buy the magazine. I think they're still mulling it. I don't think there's been any news on whether it's accepted or how much it was, but it's LVMH. They've got so much money. So we can imagine it was probably a pretty big bid. Sarah, you and I talked a little bit yesterday about, you know, tying this into consolidation in fashion media or fashion in general. LVMH is so giant. They have restaurants and hotels, and they obviously do spirits and fashion and now media as well. I mean, what's your take as someone who's been in the media business for a while on the potential of LVMH, you know, becoming a full-fledged kind of magazine publisher in addition to all the other stuff they do too?
So it's really interesting. This is chump change. Not to kind of thumb my nose at this acquisition. I think this is actually really interesting and exciting, but it's really interesting and exciting not necessarily for financial or business reasons. So when you think about LVMH, which is one of the biggest companies in Europe, I think usually is the biggest company in Europe, is only exceeded by Ozempic maker Novo Nordisk at the moment in terms of size. LVMH is 75 brands, right? These are brands that are giants like Dior, like Tiffany, which they acquired for more than $16 billion. So by comparison, I believe the deal size is estimated. I think our Paris reporter Nick Kostov has covered this really well. The deal size is about $100 million or sort of 109 million euros or thereabouts. This is not a huge deal for LVMH. This is not something that they're going to, you know, stake their business, their global business around. Nick quotes this sort of amazing Bernard Arnault line that he said in the past, that acquisition of media is for him is more like, quote, philanthropy than it is sort of setting a new business agenda or changing the direction of the company. And that speaks to the kind of business condition of media generally. But I think what you can learn from this that ties back to your prompt and our discussion about consolidation is that it's more about LVMH's influence and their relationship with power. So Paris Match, if you've ever seen it, is kind of a blend of old American Life magazine meets, I spoke about Tatler, meets a bit of Tatler or Vanity Fair, meets Hello. So it covers politicians, it covers the aristocracy in Europe, it covers monarchs, it covers kind of elite and traditional corridors of power. It's weekly, it's very photo-driven. It's known culturally in France as kind of the sort of photo album of the French, or the, you know, it marks the passage of time and the passage of power, largely through photography and lifestyle-driven coverage of powerful people. So I think to sort of reflect on consolidation through this acquisition, this is more about LVMH's really existence in Europe and particularly within France as its own, it's the size of a government. You know, it is as powerful and influential as a government, more than many governments globally. And I think it makes complete sense for them in that their reader, certainly the subject of Paris Match pieces and the reader of Paris Match, is very much who LVMH believes their customer is. So it is just an additional adjacency for them in the world of media and marketing, expressing their power.
Yeah. No, I think you make a lot of good points. It's almost, you know, given the size of LVMH, it's almost surprising if they didn't own a magazine or they didn't own some, you know, and especially working in media, it is a little bit weird sometimes realizing that my job or like the companies that I've worked at are often kind of like trophies for some people to, you know, acquire.
That's right.
just because they don't make a lot of money. I mean, or that they're certainly not as immediately lucrative as more consumer goods kind of things. But a lot of Jeff Bezos owns a newspaper. You know, the guy who owns the LA Times, I'm forgetting his name, is another, you know, I think he's a biotech billionaire or something. I think for a lot of individual people like Bernard Arnault, but also companies, it's like they buy a magazine or they buy a newspaper, not necessarily because, like you said, they're expecting to make a ton of money off of it, but more, it's almost like a branding thing. Yes, LVMH should own a magazine as some important part of the French media. That just makes sense for what they, how they present themselves as this French institution. Like you said, they're the size of many governments or bigger. It's interesting. Also, Paris Match to me as an American, you know, media consumer, visually the magazine kind of looks like the sort of grocery store tabloids that you see in America, but it definitely doesn't have that reputation. It's
That's
much
right.
more prestigious.
It is a funny blend in that way. Mm-hmm. If you're exactly right. It is weekly, it is glossy, it features not just politicians and royals, but also sort of famous celebrities on the cover. So it does have that. You would think that it might be more of a People or an Us Weekly, but it actually has a fair amount of news reporting. It often has stories on powerful people. Nick's story really compellingly points out from a few days ago from over the weekend, points out how Paris Match before this acquisition covered, for example, Delphine Arnault's wedding and in detail and how her gown was made, but also who was in attendance, the powerful people in her orbit and in the Arnault family orbit. So they already kind of cover this world. They aren't actually the who wore it best to the Oscars once you open it. But yeah, it is. It's also not, it wouldn't stand alone in the LVMH media portfolio. He, Mr. Arnault, also owns a classical radio station. He owns, I think, France's largest daily financial paper. So there are other things in the portfolio. I think this is more obviously a sort of media marketing extension than perhaps a classical radio station, which of course makes sense with spirits and hospitality, but this is a really visual way to put yourself in proximity with power.
Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. We should also mention that LVMH has a huge portfolio of stuff that they own, but then also through their investment arm, through luxury ventures, they touch, you know, a million other companies too. There's a lot of even fashion brands that they invest in, Aimee Leon Dior, Gabriella Hearst. I think they have some minority stake in Hodinkee, which is kind of a media brand as well. So they're everywhere. They touch everything. Another story that I wanted to bring into this conversation is the ongoing deal between Tapestry and Capri Holdings. The latest news on that deal is the EU said that they would decide on whether they're going to approve the deal by next month. The deal being the sale of Capri Holdings, which owns brands like Michael Kors, to Tapestry, which owns brands like Coach and Kate Spade. The thing that's interesting to me about this, you know, again, speaking of consolidation, there's lots of these large European conglomerates like LVMH, but also Kering and Richemont. There's not quite an American counterpart to them. And I think if Tapestry buys Capri, that would definitely make them the closest thing to a sort of American LVMH. Not quite on the same scale. LVMH is so gigantic, but definitely the closest thing, I think, to an American luxury conglomerate on the same level.
That's right. So in contrast to the, you know, LVMH charming, larkish, Paris match tie-up, this is actually a deal with a huge amount of stakes and kind of tension and sweep. It's an enormous deal, especially, as you said, for the American luxury market, which is much smaller than its European counterparts. This is, I believe, an $8.5 billion potential deal. And that would ultimately put the combined entity still very far behind LVMH in terms of global market share, still well behind Kering also in global market share, but somewhere, using the best and most recently available data that we have, somewhere between the size of Chanel and Hermès. So on the footing of a European luxury, larger scale company, but still far behind the kind of industry leaders. The tension here is that you are looking at two different portfolios of companies, and not every company within each portfolio is of equal health. You have some really strong drivers. You do have a potentially magic-making match in taking these American stalwarts like Coach, for example, which is doing well, like Michael Kors, and bringing them more into a European luxury conversation by tying them together with a Versace or a Jimmy Choo that you see under Tapestry. So it has the potential to really work and excel. I think the tension, the drama, the reason to pop the popcorn perhaps is that, again, when you're entering a field with these large family-controlled European luxury conglomerates like Kering, for example, like LVMH, which we just talked about, even, you know, Hermès and Chanel, also still family-controlled, and you're looking instead at a, you know, multinational tie-up that's going to have, you know, a board and not family controlled and not necessarily the margins, the reserves to take their time, to move slowly, to pivot. They're really going to need to pull this together and reorganize strategically quite quickly. And I think that's always really tense around fashion and luxury. It is, there are geopolitical factors you have to consider about which markets are doing well and why. It's an election year in the U.S. The U.S. market is a priority for many brands, but also struggling in other sectors. So there's just a lot of factors outside of their control that once they tie up together, they don't have the reserves, the time, or that sort of insulation of a family's incredibly deep-pocketed wealth to kind of loaf around and see what happens.
Right. And like a lot of classic, you know, American-European contrast is that all of the companies involved in the Tapestry and Capri deal are all fairly young. I think maybe...
That's right.
You know, Michael, like Capri Holdings came out of Michael Kors, which I think was founded in the 80s. Whereas a lot of the LVMH or Kering brands are, you know, 100 years old or something. And like you said, they've been run by the same family for generations. And that's such a classic. I mean, you go back to like any Henry James novel will note the difference between, you know, the European mindset, which is this deep, like, tradition that goes back hundreds of years, and then the American mindset, which is all new and, you know, very capitalist and all built up in such a short amount of time. New money, old money kind of contrast too.
That's right. That's right. Even Coach, which is probably the, I believe possibly the oldest brand that we're talking about here, is still relatively young compared to, again, some of LVMH's, you know, spirits holdings are centuries old.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny sometimes when you look at brands and, you know, there's a brand founded 10 years ago and they're, you know, talking about their history. And then you go to some European brand and it's like, we invented the clock, like we invent, you know, or something like that. I was just talking, this is a total tangent, but I was talking with the US president of Leica, the camera company Leica, and he just casually mentioned that they invented autofocus. And it's like, that's what happens when you're with a brand that has that deep heritage.
Right.
It's like, we shaped this entire category.
Right. When you've had hundreds of years to refine and evolve and innovate, yeah, you kind of have a jump on the market.
Cool. Let's move on to our next topic. I wanted to talk a little bit about the potential TikTok ban. There's been a lot of, you know, a little bit of confusion and theorizing about what exactly this is going to mean and how it's going to work out. I'm pretty sure you guys have covered it. We've covered it. The latest news is that the TikTok ban bill passed in the House, but not yet in the Senate. Basically, it would give ByteDance, which is the owner of TikTok, 6 months to either sell the app to a company not affiliated with the Chinese government, or else it will become basically illegal to host TikTok on any U.S. app store. So the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store, anything like that. Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, I think there's a lot of thoughts moving around about how exactly this would even work, if it's even possible. One of the things that stands out to me is if they force ByteDance to sell TikTok, my first question is, who would buy TikTok? But then maybe the better question is, who can buy TikTok? It's, you know, who can afford to buy TikTok? It's, there's no way they'll sell it for anywhere less than, you know, maybe tens of billions of dollars or something. And like, who even has that money that wouldn't also immediately cause a huge antitrust concern? You know, if Meta bought TikTok, I feel like that would immediately trigger some regulatory investigation. So I don't even know who could even take TikTok on. I don't know. I'm rambling, but what are your thoughts
on
the potential
here? No, if you're rambling, it's because this is the most opaque and unknown news issue, not just of the week, of the year so far. There is so little that is known about what's ahead for this. In my opinion, we'll be talking about this throughout the year up until the election. It's not at all clear there's going to be this decisive up or down in the Senate now that it's passed the House, and then it will all be decided. It's something that I think will stay in the ether throughout this election year. In terms of who will buy them, that is one of the most interesting questions here. Obviously, this morning that we're speaking, Steve Mnuchin has put together a consortium of potential buyers. There's thought there that that is attempting to kind of assert quick primacy that may lure more people into the fold, that may scare some people away. I believe it's also been reported that Bobby Kotick of Activision might also put together a consortium. I don't know how likely that is, but he has been speculated as a potential buyer. Other people as well. I think we have no idea if we'll even get to that point or if there will be legislation that you know, somehow enables its ownership structure to stay. The two root pieces of concern here, the first is around, of course, data collection, which I think has been very extensively reported on, and risk of surveillance, even though the company says that all data only goes to Oracle servers in the U.S., there are, you know, abiding concerns about
Texas,
the fact that, correct, that, you know, around data transparency and privacy in general, that if ByteDance is bound to share its data with the Communist Party in China, what does that mean for U.S. collected data ultimately? But the other issue I think that probably colors more of the acceleration and panic that we've seen this week and definitely is motivating, I believe, proponents of this bill more is just the opacity of this algorithm, its clear strength, some might say, extremely addictive properties. Certainly my husband would probably say that when he sees me scrolling TikTok every single evening before bed. And the way that that kind of paves the road ultimately to national security issues, ability to turn tides, opinions, influence American political outcomes, influence American political debate.
that's obviously addictive algorithmness is obviously much more difficult to police with legislation than location of server.
Right.
It's TikTok's algorithm that is its strength and now ultimately, you know, may hinder it here. So I think this is a really fascinating debate that no one knows what's going to happen next. It's obviously going to go to the Senate, but even the disparity between President Biden being on TikTok ahead of the election, but also pledging to sign a ban if it reaches his desk, that in itself is a fascinating, you know,
very
dialectic.
Weird contradiction where it's like,
completely.
We want to ban it, but while it's here, we might as well use it to connect with voters. Yeah, there's a couple, you know, interesting things I wanted to double up on. So the algorithm being so addictive, like you said, it's hard to police that. It's hard to find a legal justification for you made an app that's too fun to use and, you know,
correct.
That you can't do that anymore. The other thing is, I think there it's hard. Actually, I'll come back to that in a second. I was going to say the 6-month time limit on them finding a buyer, I feel like they're going to blow past that because there are I'm sure there are so many ways to delay, to challenge in court, to appeal. You know, ByteDance is very resourceful. I'm not a legal expert, but I feel like there's going to be some ways for them to prolong that process. And then the other thing is, you know, you mentioned the addictiveness of the algorithm. There of the concerns that the proponents of the bill have kind of laid out, to me, there's most of them feel very applicable to all like social media platforms, including American ones.
Correct.
Which doesn't necessarily mean that it's okay, but it is kind of interesting to me, like, you know, are they collecting data on their users? Well, definitely they are. And, you know, so is Meta and so is, you know, X and all that. Not again, not to excuse anything, but like I do think it's interesting, you know, what elements are unique to TikTok and what seem to me more just like, you know, issues to do with social media in general. I do think the bill talks a lot about specifically the connection to the Chinese government. And I get that that's a unique thing that Meta, like, for example, doesn't have. But I don't know, do you agree that some of the criticisms I think in there are absolutely applicable to other platforms as well?
Completely. I completely agree with you. I think this is the most, again, one of the fascinating aspects of this that, you know, Meta, as you said, X, obviously American owned and operated. We report, as I'm sure you guys do constantly, on issues of safety, not only around security and privacy and global issues of inciting violence or prejudice through some of those platforms, but domestically at the moment, this is reaching a real fever pitch around what's shown to children and teens and how you deal with predators and pedophiles running rampant on these platforms or the extent to which troubling mental health crises are gaining steam through these platforms. So it's while it's actually very reasonable and easy to see after recent elections, after January 6th, why the government would want to limit the strength or unchecked progress of a new platform that might eventually have those same problems, I'm not exactly clear personally from what I've seen. And again, there's just a total cloud of unknowable yeah. question marks here.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly clear how an American owner operator would, as a fact by itself, 100% guarantee a perfectly safe, sanitized environment for users. It's not clear at all.
Yeah, no, extremely unclear. And then one other thing that I wanted to mention is that, so, you know, we talked about how a big, you know, part of the bill is specifically TikTok's connection to the Chinese government. There's been a couple other pieces of legislation recently. I just wrote about the America's Trade and Investment Act, which is a bill. I wrote about it because there's some provisions in there for resale and circularity in fashion. But the bulk of that bill is about strengthening trade and manufacturing partnerships within the Americas, so between the U.S. and Mexico and different countries in South America, Central America, Canada, the Caribbean, all that stuff. And they say pretty openly in the bill that they want to like strengthen ties in the Western Hemisphere to counter, you know, China's web of partnerships in the Eastern Hemisphere. So it feels like there's a good amount of concern and legislation coming out or being proposed right now specifically to kind of counter what people perceive as like this growing influence of China kind of globally. This is getting into more geopolitical stuff than maybe fashion necessarily, but I mean, it's all connected.
And hey, it's all related. No, yeah. I think you're looking at two things, right? You're looking at wanting to grow the Western and Northern Hemisphere to be more competitive. So with those supply chain relationships, with those networks, as you said, but you're also looking at, and this is particularly affects the larger luxury conglomerates that we talked about earlier, you are looking at fears in the marketplace around overexposure and to China and expectations that they have counted on reliable growth, on a fast rebound from COVID, on a safe geopolitical situation, on peace and stability vis-a-vis Taiwan that may or may not last. And so I think there's a sense of wanting to diversify beyond just complete reliance on the Chinese market. And it comes, again, from both altruistic, in air quotes, aims maybe of like building up our closer relationships with those nearest to us, but also fear that we have overcorrected or kind of overexposed a certain market to and predicated it on Chinese strength in perpetuity.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, to bring it back to what you were saying about, for example, Biden being on TikTok, it feels like there is a movement like we shouldn't be so reliant on China. But since we are, I'm going to keep like, you know, selling in China and getting material from China and manufacturing in China, which is like, you know, that's neither here nor there. But it is funny, the kind of like double consciousness sometimes. A lot of the fashion brands I cover have, you know, very strong business relationships in China. They sell in China. They want that customer because it's a huge market, at the same time as they acknowledge like not wanting to be so reliant. So I don't know. It's an interesting situation. And one other thing, just to make the fashion connection clear, that the reason we're talking about TikTok is, you know, fashion brands are all in on TikTok because their customer is all in on TikTok. Even though it seems like the brands I've talked to have no idea what they're doing on TikTok. It's, you know, to use your term, it's very opaque, that algorithm. You never know what's going to take off. But when it does, it's huge for a lot of the brands that we cover.
That's right. I think most brands I've spoken to informally, not necessarily about the ban, but about their overall TikTok posture or strategy, are like, to not be there would be crazy. So we, of course, have a presence, but it's somewhat of a lark. It's not strategically backed by enormous departments or anything like that, because it certainly doesn't drive luxury transactions, at least not yet. But it does drive entry-level price point items like a luxury brand who might have a more budget sandal or a perfume. I think you've seen it, really fascinating dynamics in the cosmetics and beauty industry. But it's mainly about brand awareness, being ready for the future. And like you said, if the entirety of the next two waves of your future customer, if all of Gen Z and all of Gen Alpha are there,
yeah,
you can't afford to not be there.
You don't want to skip that. Yeah. I want to talk about one final topic, a little bit lighter compared to the intense geopolitical stuff we were just talking about, but the Oscars were this past weekend. I am a big cinephile personally, and so like all cinephiles, I hate the Oscars. They make me so angry, unless the movies I like win, but usually they don't, and it just like drives me insane. Sarah, we were talking yesterday about reading the interviews with the voters after the fact where they're like, yeah, I didn't watch any of them. I just like picked one at random. That drives me crazy.
It's crazy.
But there were a lot of fun kind of, I mean, there's always great looks, as fashion reporters, it's always fun to watch. There's beautiful dresses. My favorite personally was Sandra Hüller from Anatomy of a Fall with that beautiful Schiaparelli dress. That was so cool. But I wanted to talk about a funny kind of moment when Emma Stone won for Best Actress. She came up on stage. She was wearing this beautiful Louis Vuitton dress, which she immediately pointed out to everyone had ripped during the ceremony. And you and I talked a little bit about, if I was a brand and I had dressed a celebrity and then they went on stage in front of everyone and told them that the dress I made ripped, I would like maybe be freaking out a little bit. But Louis Vuitton also is maybe, I don't know if anyone's going to look at that and be like, I'm not buying a Louis Vuitton dress. It ripped. You know, they've got enough prestige that maybe that's not going to happen. But it was kind of funny to just have that called out on stage. I don't know. What did you think?
I tussled with this because I actually think that while, of course, there's corners of the internet that immediately went to the extrapolatory, this says a lot about construction. Mm-hmm. I was almost more amused by it because the quote-unquote rip was, the zipper separating. She turns around on stage. So she shows off the full peplum of her gorgeous mint jacquard gown. You see beneath the open zipper is another perfectly intact zipper. So there's no, like, you see undergarments and she's, right. It's awkward. It was like the most dignified possible fashion fail in the history of all right. fashion fails. But more for Vuitton, I think specifically, they dressed Davine Joy Randolph. They dressed Emma. Obviously, that's not a surprise. She's been on contract for them for an actually hugely substantial 7 years. She's been on contract with them for a long time. But the fact that you're Vuitton, you have both this Best Supporting Actress winner, you have the Best Actress winner. The dresses are both custom, but they're very much in the Oscar style pantheon of these sort of gentle, feminine, Easter eggy colors. They still reference, though, however, motifs you just saw at Nicolas Ghesquiere's 10th anniversary show in Paris, the sort of cool borderline aquatic, scuba, in the case of her peplum, almost finishes. I think you ultimately chalk this up as a huge win for the brand exposure, rather than, they're going downhill, the zipper guy needs to be fired.
Yeah, it's like you said, it was like, if she hadn't have called it out, no one would have noticed. It wasn't like the dress was falling apart or anything. I think whatever the benefit you get from, like you said, Emma Stone gracefully twirling and showing off the whole dress and and then it being in the news that it was specifically Louis Vuitton and now everyone knows that that gorgeous dress she was wearing is Louis Vuitton. That definitely, I think, outweighs any potential, people freaking out about the build quality of a Louis Vuitton dress. Yeah, there was another thing actually at the Oscars that we didn't talk about this ahead of time, so I'm sorry for ambushing you with this, but did you see the actress Michelle Yeoh, who I love, was wearing a gorgeous Balenciaga dress, and I was talking with a friend last night that there was a weird thing with like a tag that was kind of like hanging out of the dress where it was sort of folded down and you could see that it said Balenciaga, but it was like upside down. And I was like, is that intentional? Is that supposed to look like that? Or is it
that's so interesting.
Styled wrong?
Little post-it note.
If you want, I can send you a quick image of it and then.
Yeah. I see the tag. I see the fold down.
Is it supposed to look like that? Like, it kind of looks...
Pure speculation.
Yeah.
Haven't called friends at Balenciaga to ask. I would guess that it is intentional, that it's part of the branding. She's also wearing, in addition to Balenciaga, which she also wore for the after parties, she is wearing that Richard Mille watch, the enormous watch. She's one of their most famous brand faces. Over the gloves, which you saw a lot of people wear. I mean, I think this is what you're speaking to is the interesting tension in the carpet right now, which is that you have people on contracts more than ever, again, speaking to luxury consolidation and close ties with the entertainment industry. You have so many people on contracts who are wearing gowns, albeit customized from makers they have established relationships with. But then you have the extreme other end of the spectrum, which are these incredibly creative resuscitation of vintage silhouettes, archive pieces, attention-getting surrealist styles, especially around the after parties. And then, again, within those contracts, you have people who are able to push the brands to do something that really is interesting or different or suits them, even though they are on contract. So I think the branding of the red carpet and the affiliation with certain companies has never been more prevalent, and I believe is only going to increase, again, going back to sort of at the Artemis level, Kering and CAA's relationship, that will certainly only make fashion and entertainment even closer. Vuitton is LVMH is unbelievably closely tethered to these red carpet moments, brought Davine Joy Randolph out to their show before she appeared here in this gown. I think the fact that you're even asking is it is or isn't it intentional in some way is fulfilling a mission of the brand.
Yeah. And I assume it has to be, like you said, there's a lot of investment in here. And also Michelle Yeoh, I'm certain, has a professional stylist who, like, every inch of that look was checked over before she went out there. But it was just a funny little detail. And it is funny how sometimes you can latch on to something like that. And again, now it's very memorable. And now that I know that that's a Balenciaga dress. Before we go, I also wanted to make sure we just get to one more thing on the kind of celebrity, topic, which is the Kate Middleton situation. A little bit of a tangential relationship to fashion. Obviously, the royal family and their whole entourage are like mega influencers at the same time. So like they are relevant. But that situation is so strange. I don't know. So you have some experience in the coverage of this world. I mean, what do you think about?
Well,
I feel like
it's interesting.
Yeah, go ahead.
You say that it's not fashion. However, it's all about zippers and sleeves. Mm-hmm. It's ultimately all about the raspberry sweater sleeve of a, you know, the Princess Charlotte looking fuzzy and, you know, misaligned barber zipper. What does it mean? It's a fascinating, completely fascinating scandal. How is it different? I think one thing that we're exploring through some of our reporting is how is it different from the way that the Kardashians or others get in trouble here in the U.S. and get kind of wrist slapped in the tabloid press for photoshopping themselves, putting themselves through Facetune type filters. I think the difference here is both the amateur nature of some of these errors. It's very surprising for, again, what you might call a charming family, but what many people around the world see is itself an enormous conglomerate. You know, it's a these were very sort of amateur errors. The nature of the retraction or apology was perhaps to some not plausible, that you have a recovering Princess of Wales recovering from surgery who's just having an amateur go at Photoshop, and then that's put out by an entire communications team. It just doesn't quite seem fully plausible without further information. And then I think the third thing that is quite different from celebrities, where we spend one day laughing at somebody's failure as they nip their waist in, is that this is a family that benefits from taxpayer money, that exists in a adjacent head of state capacity, that Kate is the mother of a future monarch. She is a future queen of this country. And you have manipulated imagery at a time when the family has been very tight-lipped about the actual state of her health, the state of the active monarch's health, and how well he is faring in his own battle with cancer. No one knows the severity of the cancer. No one knows the type of the cancer. No one knows how he's doing, really. So you have this perpetuation of this kind of nothing to see here mentality that, as we know, just doesn't fly in a 2024 media ecosystem.
Yeah. And I personally, I mean, I think that the truth is probably exactly what they say, which is that she's recovering from surgery and that's it. But I think if that's what it is, you should just stick with that rather than, you know, trying to kind of half-assedly make this sort of weird photo happen and then getting called out, and then it spirals into this whole thing. It probably would have been fine, maybe not fine, but at least it wouldn't have fed the flames if they were just like, she's still recovering, sorry, no news other than that. You know,
I keep thinking about today's yesterday's revelations from Olivia Munn, that she went through a private breast cancer battle and a double mastectomy. She put up photos of herself in a hospital gown. She talked about the importance of certain scans and pushing your doctor. Very honest, very transparent. Obviously, hugely personal, not something the royal family does or ever did. But you don't see people being like, I'm sure John Mulaney photoshopped this and released it from 2 years ago, and she's probably, this is Weekend at Bernie's, you know, see this horrible accusations mm-hmm. of the royal family that they are faking these photos, that she's in fact in a coma, that she's mm-hmm. having a mental mm-hmm. breakdown. So they've almost, again, I believe it to be hugely inadvertent, but they've started debate, not quelled debate.
Yeah. And made it worse through it's like the Streisand effect by trying to, quell those like rumors, they've absolutely fed the flames. And then one final thing we should talk about is, I don't know how this photo was edited, but I do think that this happening right at the same time as like generative AI is taking over everything and everyone's hyping it up. I don't know. I'm like, I'm skeptical of that kind of stuff from a business sense, like the idea that that's actually going to meaningfully change the world. I don't know if it will, but it's definitely meaningfully making things more confusing all the time. And, you know, people are already, I think, prone to doubting things that are real and believing things that are fake all the time. And then now having a super powerful, super easy way to make plausible looking but completely fake images is just going to, I think, add to the deterioration of people's ability to, like, just even trust what they're looking at. I don't know. Very strange situation we're in around that. I don't know if this photo had anything to do with AI, but it did make me think of that.
The first 24 hours, there was a lot of speculation as to whether it was AI. You had photo experts looking at it, unable to tell, versus just amateur lasso tool, blur tool, Photoshop stuff. I think you're exactly right. There's that the famous, you know, Pope in his puffer photo that went around the world through generative AI. And the reason that goes crazy, and is everywhere is not necessarily because it's artificial photograph, but because it's the Pope, who is very powerful and has a lot of power. So I think when we're talking about people in positions of power and manipulated imagery, particularly in the U.S., we just have this visceral reaction to that, a visceral fear of sort of being controlled that we reject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to bring it all full circle and kind of finish our conversation, you and I are both in media. I don't want the amazing writers and photographers and you know, people that you and I work with all the time to have their incredible and very difficult work, you know, replaced by something that's like easy and cheap and also completely misleading. So I think there definitely needs to be some more intense conversations about generative AI, both text and image and now video with the release of Sora. So I don't know how that's all going to play out. Media is already kind of a strange, volatile landscape at the best of times. And I don't know if ChatGPT and OpenAI is going to help a ton there. Any final thoughts you have on Kate Middleton, AI, any of the stuff we were talking about? Because I feel like this has been a wild conversation. We went a lot of different directions, but it's been great to have you. But and any final thoughts you wanted to share before we...
No, this has been a great conversation. I feel like this has been the agenda of like, agenda of United Nations or discussion week in review. It's interchangeable. Yeah. These are the major issues of our time. It's been delightful to talk about them with you.
It has been great, Sarah. Thank you so much for being here. For those of you listening, don't forget to give us a rating and a review, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to this, that helps us out so much. And don't forget to subscribe to the Glossy Podcast, because you'll hear interviews with industry insiders every Wednesday. You'll hear week in review episodes with me every Friday. And sometimes we cross it over by having an industry insider like Sarah with us for the week in review. So thank you for listening. And once again, Sarah, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me.